Okay, well, we're going to continue our worship time here as we look into God's Word and kind of see what it has to say for us today. We've started this series on perspective, and it's a study of the book of Philippians. And let me just give you a thought here, kind of a definition of perspective. It's this. The perspective would be this. It would be the capacity to view things in their true relations or relative importance. The capacity to view things in their true relations and relative importance. I don't know about you, but sometimes the definition makes total sense, right? It's very simple. It's very straightforward. Being able to see things in their true relations, how it all fits. But there are times when that gets really hard to do. May I just for a second, it would be crazy, foolish, very insensitive if we didn't talk about Las Vegas for a moment. And I don't know about you, but what happened in Las Vegas feels like a month ago to me. It feels like so long ago. It was really literally a week ago this tonight that it happened. And I think for all of us, it probably, well, maybe this first line, trying to make sense of the senseless, trying to have perspective, trying to see how things line up, trying to see how things in their true relationship. And here this incredibly tragic thing happens, and we can't actually figure it out. We can't really get it. So far, at least, the information, you got to ask, why? What in the world was going on here? Why would he do such a stupid, incredibly destructive thing? Why? And there's no direct answer yet. There's nothing that seems to make sense. I don't know about you, but it sets me a little bit off kilter to try to say, what in the world was that all about? But the hard thing, I think, as Americans today is we just came off a series of hurricanes that, in a sense, didn't make sense either. Not too long ago, there was an almost equally horrific act in Orlando that killed 49 people. And it's almost like we as Americans now just live from one tragedy to the next, you know? And I don't know about you, but it's hard after a while to fit it together, to make sense of it, to somehow, I mean, how many people I read, and I felt too this week, and I think probably you did too. You just felt sick to your stomach when you heard this. You just got physically ill to say, what? What? A wealthy accountant decides to make an army of himself? Something's messed up here, right? So the second thought in all of that for me was a reminder of the potential of evil in mankind. And we don't want to really talk about that. We don't want to relate to that. We don't want to admit that. We don't really enjoy that. That's very uncomfortable. It just doesn't feel good. But the potential for evil in mankind is real. And this, obviously, is one guy out of millions who would ever do anything like that, out of hundreds of millions. But I think there's something about it that grabs the little piece of our own soul that has the ability for evil. And so there is a reminder in this for that. But there is also a reminder, I think, this next line, a reminder of the redemptive goodness that can surface in mankind. And so all the stories that you began to hear of people who risked their lives and even gave their lives for other people in Las Vegas. And we can take that story and expand it far beyond Las Vegas, right? The kind of things that people have the ability to do what is good. And do what is right, and do what is honorable. And try to make sense of it all. The last thing I think is really true is the reminder of our need for God to be present. And our need for him to move in our midst. I think you probably all felt that at one level or another this week. To say, God, man, I need you. These people need you. There are people who are still in the hospital fighting for their lives, who are trying to recover from significant, incredible injuries. There are families who are trying to recover from this and probably will never recover totally of having lost loved ones. This isn't something that you deal with in a week and now it's gone. It lasts for their whole lives. God, we need you in the midst. I was talking to a friend of mine this week who another friend had said to him, who is now not a believer in any way, shape, or form, and said, all of these thoughts and prayers are worthless As people were saying online, hey, your thoughts and your prayers, our thoughts and our prayers are with people. And he said, hey, look, it's worthless. There's no God. There's nothing out there. All your good thoughts are worthless. Do something, will you? Stop thinking good thoughts because they don't do anything. Your prayers are totally worthless. There's no God who's going to move. So all your thoughts and your prayers are stupid, basically, is what he was saying. And I understand, if there is no God, he's right. He is totally right. All our good thoughts and prayers, they are a waste of time. But I did begin to think of those people, those families, and those injured, and those who were affected by all of this. I'll bet if we said we'd like our prayers and our thoughts to be with you, that they'd say, thank you. Thank you. We need it. Because I can't go to the hospital in Las Vegas right now. Most of us can't do that today. But there are some people there who are helping. And our thoughts and prayers matter, I think. If there's a God. If there's no God, then it doesn't matter, right? It's like a waste. It's this nice religious game that we play, or we could play. But I don't think that's exactly true. I think there's something worthwhile about it. So to connect that, in a sense, with where we've been going this past few weeks, is the reality that there are highs and lows in life, right? Of course there are. There are beautiful things. All those incredible stories of heroism and people, those are incredibly highs. Those are beautiful things. But there are lows. There are ugly, gross, disgusting, horrific, tragic things that happen in our lives, in our midst, and in our city, in our state, in our country, and throughout the world. There are goods and there are bads. That's the reality of it. There are victories and there are defeats. That is the definition of our lives. And really the question then is, how do we integrate this dichotomy? How do we make sense of it all? How do we line it up? How do we understand all of this? And really the answer is by keeping perspective. We have to keep a true perspective, understand it for what it really is. And the next question would be, how can you keep perspective? Well, it's got to be by seeing life from God's point of view. If there is a God, if he's real, and if he's true, then we have to see it from his point of view. Or at least try to see it from his point of view. And how do we get that? Next question is, how can we discover his point of view? And it's by seeing it in his word. If he left his word for us, if he gave us his word to describe it for us, and especially in his son, he describes who he is and how he sees life through his son. Jesus, walking among us, lived out an incredible life, and he showed us what it was all about. And so we got to look at him, because he is the Word, right? John 1:1 says, for in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word of God came alive in the person of Christ, and he lived among us and walked among us, and we get to see what it's all about. And so we got to have perspective, I think. Here's kind of the definition from last week. We have a one-point perspective. We talked about best pieces of art that were done from a one-point perspective, that it all goes to that. And here we're saying that perspective comes from a one-point place that is Christ. And we go back to that and say, okay, what does it teach us? What does he teach us? What does he show us? And a one-point perspective is this. It is the ability to see how things fit together in our lives in light of the sovereign and redemptive purposes of Christ. It's to see how all of this fits together according to what he's doing. Wow. Both in eternity, right? Because there's something beyond this world. There is an eternity. It's described. You and I were made for eternity. That's why death feels so inappropriate, because we can't deal with it. Because we were never made for death. We were made for life. And with death entered into the world, there was something so rude about it, so inappropriate about it. Because we were made for eternity, and that's where we're headed, as well as his daily work in our lives here through the truth of his word and the presence of his spirit. That's what it is. And to put it maybe in our theme here, it is, in spite of all the highs and lows, the goods and bads, the victories and defeats in our lives, in spite of all of that, Paul, in this letter to Philippians, believes that God is trustworthy and that he is inclined towards us rather than against us. And that living with that in mind can set our direction and establish our stability even when the world is beyond our ability to control. To be able to see, okay, God, you're still in charge. I get it. And I can order my life according to that. And you can order my life according to that. Wow. So here's where we started last week. Beth had it right down, right? Here's the deal. Last week we talked about that God is not finished with us. that he's not, his work is still, we're still a work in progress. I don't know about you, but I find that to be tremendously hopeful. Sometimes I feel still very undeserved of that. But God isn't done with me, and he's not done with the people next to me. He's not done with my kids. You know, for those of you who have adult kids, or even any kid at all, it is like so nice to go, okay, God is not done. He's still working. I'd like to get in there and do some things. I'd like to give some directive. I'd like to see if I can control their lives, but you can't do it. And it can be, and then you say, okay, God, they're still yours. You're still working. I don't know about you, but that's very helpful. And then the reality last week that God will be faithful to do his part in transforming our lives using the ultimate quality of love. If there's ever a tool or a quality that God wants to use to transform us, it is the issue of love. And in the end, that love will reveal his glory in our lives. Okay? So, this week, here's the big idea. I want to just keep going in the next section of Philippians. Here's the big idea this week, that we are not victims of our circumstances nor dissuaded by the ill intent of others. Those are pretty heavy thoughts. So we're going to jump in and do it, but we are not victims of our circumstances, nor are we dissuaded, discouraged by the ill intent of others in life. Okay? So let's jump in and see what we can find in Philippians chapter 1, verses 12 through 18. And here's where we're going with that. He says this as a result of that first section. He says, I want you to know, brothers. So he's writing to the Philippians, right? And where's he writing from? Anybody remember? He's writing from Rome to Philippi, who is not too far from Bulgaria, just so you know. So this is not very far from where Sean lives. Because it's, in fact, it was called Macedonia, which is a republic now that's part of the old part of Yugoslavia. But then Macedonia took up part of Bulgaria and part of Albania and part of Yugoslavia and part of Greece. And so it's a place not too far from Sean's home. It's this place called Philippi. And he writes to him and he says, hey, brothers, he'd been there three times, right? He'd been there on two of his journeys. On one of those journeys, he went there twice. So he'd been to this city three different times. And he wants them to know, hey, brothers, as he planted the church there, right? He went there and he shared the gospel and people came to Christ. Lydia, this really very effective entrepreneurial woman having her own business, she took him into their house and took care of them for a while. There was also the Philippian jailer he led to Christ and his whole household. And he leads all these people to Christ and the church begins to grow. And this is 10 years later. 52, he had visited there originally. Now it's 62 AD. And he says, I want you to know, brothers, what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. So you have to ask the question, well, what happened to you? Right? Well, they knew what had happened to him, but let me just remind you. What has happened to him? Now, he'd been in ministry for 30 years. He had taken three major ministry trips, okay? The last trip was to gather funds to take back to Jerusalem because they'd had an incredible famine. People were dying of this famine, and they didn't have much money, and they couldn't gather stuff on their own, and so they needed funds to buy and import goods to survive. So he took this big trip, and he collected funds, and he brought it back. But when he got back and he delivered this gift, then everything began to go downhill. Just so you know, he went back to Jerusalem, and the Jews there were not very pleased with him because they said, you're preaching something that's an abomination. We need to get rid of you. And so they came up with a plan to murder him. 40 men decided to take a vow that they would not eat or drink until he was murdered. Now, you guys, you can't live a long time without drinking. You have to have water periodically. In fact, you're only going to live a few days, less than a week. And they said, we're not going to eat or drink until you're murdered. It's incredible. And in the process of that, they found out about it, and Paul appeals to the Roman government, and he says, hey, I'm a Roman citizen. You can't send me back to Jerusalem to be tried where they're going to murder me. I'm a Roman citizen. I appeal to Caesar. And right then, the Roman governor was responsible to either judge him himself or to send him to Rome to be judged. And they decided after 2 years of house arrest, they kept him there kind of on ice, if you will, for more than really 2 years, First of all, under Felix, and when he died, then Festus took over and said, hey, I'm tired of you being around. Why don't you guys just send him to Rome? And so they put him on a boat for Rome to be tried there. On the way to Rome, it was an incredibly horrible journey. They went by boat across the Mediterranean. It was a terrible time. Paul was very knowledgeable about these things, and they went at the worst time of the year. And he said, you guys, if we keep doing this, we're all going to get killed. And in fact, when they got pretty far west on the Mediterranean, when they got near Malta, God really spoke to Paul and said, hey, look, this whole boat's going down, and everything in it's going down. Only the people are going to survive. And that's exactly what happened. Off the coast of Malta, the thing was destroyed, and they all made it to shore, and they spent the winter on Malta and before they could get another boat. And so then they took a boat, and he was sent to Rome, and he's under house arrest. And he's under house arrest under the government of Nero. And Nero was an incredibly brutal man. And he eventually came to the place where they were persecuting Christians. He was literally using them as torches in his garden. They would dip them in wax and hang them on trees and burn them alive. It's not a very fun time. He's not been having a good time. This has been a brutal trip. And he says to this, and I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. I don't know about you guys, but it seems to me he could be feeling sorry for himself and none of us would blame him, right? You just think, man, if he had to be down and say, I quit, I've had enough, I'm done, this is too hard. This has been brutal. I've been beaten. I've been stoned. I've been shipwrecked. I've been whipped. Enough is enough. I'm done. But he says, all this has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. Now, that's quite a perspective, isn't it? Look at this. So that, as a result, it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest of my imprisonment is for Christ. I want you to know that now I have had a captive audience. In all of this traveling, all of my time being imprisoned in Caesarea, which is back near Jerusalem, which is over there, I'm sorry, on our map. 2 years there, I'd been guarded. And there's this guard that keeps rotating in and out. And for every one of them, I get to talk to them about Christ. I get to tell them, because they all knew that it was Christ that he was being imprisoned, right? It wasn't for having done something wrong. He didn't break any laws. He had done nothing wrong both to the Jews nor to the Romans. They only imprisoned him because of this thing called Jesus, and people weren't happy with him about it. And so he said, man, this guard keeps coming in, and I keep telling him about Christ. There's no one else to tell. I can't go out, so I might as well talk about who he brings in, right? It's a little bit like reaching international people. You know, in St. Louis, there are 200,000 immigrants. We could go to the world and tell them about Christ, which we need to do. And weirdly enough, God has brought them to us. It's amazing. And here, he kept bringing these guys, these Roman soldiers, and he kept sharing Christ with them. And then on this trip all the way to Rome, he shares Christ with them. And when he gets to Rome, he's imprisoned for 2 more years. And he keeps telling people about Christ. Now, he didn't get to go out in the marketplace like he had earlier in his ministry. But he got to tell these guys who kept coming. And then all of a sudden, inside the Roman guard, inside this imperial, this totally, they're like the SEALs, if you will. They're like the Rangers of the Roman army. And he keeps telling them about Christ because they keep coming to him. It's amazing. Throughout all this situation, I have been able to share Christ with all of those in the imperial guard. Wow, what an incredible thing. Now look at this in verse 14. And he says, and most of the brothers, not all of them, but most of them, as a result, look at this, have become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment. Because they've watched him. They've heard about it. They watched how he responded and what he said and his attitude and his boldness. They'd watched him. And he says, and having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, they are much more bold to speak the word without fear. You see, in all of this chaos, in all of this persecution, they became more bold, not less bold. They had a message of hope for a world. And having watched Paul do it so well, they were bold about their faith. Wow. You guys, let me just stop and say, so therefore, what now? We have two pieces we're going to do that in today. I usually hold this to the end, but I think we got to do it in two pieces here. First of all, this. Let me ask you a question. Like Paul, is there a difficult circumstance in your life that would tend to pull you down, but actually is an opportunity for the gospel to be advanced by the way you respond or the words that you have to share? Now, the answer to that is yes. You do. We all do. We have difficult circumstances that we're in the midst of, that we find ourselves in. Yours may be different than mine, but you have them. I know you do. Is there a difficult circumstance in your life today that would tend to pull you down, tend to really want to undermine you, would tend to want to, for you to say, I quit, I'm done. I don't want it anymore, it's too much. But actually, it's an opportunity for the gospel to be advanced by the way you respond or the words that you use. Maybe in simple form, let me put it this way. Do not waste your pain. Don't waste your pain. There are hard things. And sometimes we waste it. We just kind of flush it away. Don't let your pain be unusable. God will use it. I think that's what Paul would be saying here is, this has been a very difficult thing. I've been through a ton, but God has something in it for me. And in fact, he brought all these guys to me so I could share Christ with them. And now the entire imperial guard heard the gospel. And some of them have come to faith, no doubt. And now from the inside of the Roman Empire, they're beginning to have guys who are walking with Jesus, who believe in his love and his grace and his power. And they begin to spread it through the entire Roman army. Wow. You couldn't even get into a place like that. I have a friend, more of an acquaintance, actually, who was on staff with Campus Crusade for Christ years ago. And they decided, this was before the Iron Curtain came down and before there was any break in that whole system, and they decided to send them into the Soviet Union. And so they had to be officially taken off the rolls of Campus Crusade because we couldn't really say they were on staff. And they ended up living in Moscow. And one of them ended up in such an incredible position that he got to share Christ with President Brezhnev. It's amazing. What looked like a very difficult situation, he worked his way to the very top of the Soviet government. Not as an officer, just as a strange American who got to share Christ with Brezhnev. You never know how God's going to use your difficulty, your situation. You never know. But if you have a difficult circumstance, maybe God could use it. And we all have them. Second point, I think, in this passage, then, is 15 to 18. And he changes his tone just a little bit, or his direction, but it's really the same difficult things that he's talking about. Look at this in verse 15. Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. Let's just define this just for a second. These are really powerful. Some indeed preach Christ, he says, and some do it out of envy. Here's the definition of envy from the Greek. It is the miserable trait of being glad when someone experiences misfortune or pain. There were some who were advancing the gospel, preaching the gospel, and we don't know if this is in Rome or in Philippi. That would be the most logical places where it would be done. But they're in the ministry, and they're advancing the ministry, but frankly, what's going on is they're doing it out of envy, this miserable trait of being glad when someone else experiences misfortune or pain. They do it from envy, and they even do it for rivalry. Here's the definition of rivalry. Literally, it means to quarrel or create strife, an affection for conflict and a demand to be right, a contentious spirit. Some are preaching the gospel from envy and rivalry. Doesn't sound very good. Sounds so inappropriate. These are people who are involved in the ministry and involved in the gospel, advancing the gospel, but really what they have is an agenda that they are pushing of envy and rivalry. But others, look at this, the second part of that sentence, but others from goodwill. Others out of a goodwill. Look at, here's the definition of goodwill. It is a good-willed intention that is aimed at peace and unity for the good of the human spirit, for the good of what God wants to do. They are a good-willedness. You know, I think at the end of the day, that's what we're looking for in people, is there a simple good-willedness. It doesn't mean they have to be perfect. That's what we're looking for in our marriages. That's what Emerson Eggerich, the author of Love and Respect, always says, is at the end of the day, husbands and wives are a little bit different, and they see things differently, and periodically, once in a blue moon, have a little bit of conflict. Okay, once in a while, have conflict. Okay, every day, have conflict. And at the end of the day, you're going to say, I think they're a knucklehead. I think they're strange. I think they see things weird. Man, they're put together so... I can't even say it. You know, like, okay. But at the end of the day, you have to step back and say, do I believe there is a good-willed intention in them? Or is there not? I think that's what we look for in every relationship. At the end of the day, is there a good-willedness about it? Do they need to be perfect? No. No, they don't. Because none of us are perfect about it. We all make mistakes. We all have our places. We all can be, you know, a kind of a horse's patoot periodically, if you know what I mean. And we can be that way. But is there fundamentally, deep down, a good-willed intention? And that's what he's saying. Some indeed preach Christ from envy or rivalry, but others from goodwill. Now, let's go. For some, the latter, meaning the ones with goodwill. So we have an arrow here, right? We'll go from the latter, from the goodwill. The latter do it of love, out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. Because they're sharing Christ, understanding that I'm here for the defense of the gospel too, and they do it out of a real love, out of a deep set agape love for each other, that they do it from there. But it says here in verse 17, the former, the ones from first, the ones who preach Christ from envy or rivalry, the former proclaim Christ out of a selfish ambition. And then listen to this. This is the hardest part, I think. But from a selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. They're preaching the gospel out of envy and rivalry, had become very personal against Paul. They had him in their sights, and they wanted to do him harm. I think what's going on here, if Paul would say here in a moment, but what he's going to say is, the content of their gospel was right on. But the content of their heart was all messed up. Now, you guys, picture it for a second here. Paul had met Jesus on the road to Damascus in this incredibly dramatic experience. He had gone to Jerusalem out there after that to present himself to the elders of the Christian church and to say, God's changed my life. And they go, that's cool, but there's not a lot of people around here who trust you because you are persecuting us. So I think you ought to take about a 5-year sabbatical and head home to Tarsus for a while because people are not real happy with you. It's not going to work very well. And that's exactly what he did. He took a 5-year, not vacation. He went up there and did the gospel, but we don't know much about it. And after that, they went and grabbed him and said, hey, would you come help us in Antioch? Because we have this new church called Gentiles, and we don't have a clue what to do with it. And so they brought him in and involved him in the ministry. And then they said, hey, would you start taking the gospel all over the world for us? Would you take a trip into Turkey first? And then would you go into Europe secondly? And would you go even farther? Would you do that for us? And then he had risked his life. Like I said, he's been shipwrecked, beat, stoned, whipped. And then they're trying to rip him to shreds? Are you kidding? I don't know, how would you respond to that? If you spent 30 years doing that, how would that feel? I don't know about you, but I think he probably wanted to see if he could talk to him. Or question it, or I don't know what he just, I'm sure he wasn't having a good time. And so then look at verse 18 then. This is wild. This is crazy. This is like nutty. What then? What do you do then? And he's instructing them to keep perspective, right? So he says, only that in every way, whether in pretense, whether in their own agenda, or in the truth. Look at this. Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. And rejoice is not a soft word. It's a really strong word, full of great joy. He jumped for joy that the gospel of Christ was being advanced. He's kind of like saying, hey, look, I'm not the issue. They can rip on me all they want. I just want the name of Christ to be advanced. And in that, he rejoices. What a perspective, right? It's an incredible thought. He was so glad. Because he's in jail. He knows he can't really go that far, right? I mean, he's in house arrest. Who's going to take the gospel to the rest of the world? They were. And he said, right on, go for it. Wow, that's quite a perspective. That takes a lot of maturity. That takes a ton. So, therefore, what now? Let me just ask you this question. Has the ministry become an inappropriate personal agenda, rivalry, and envy? It happens. It's easy. The answer, I think, is do not let yourself get hijacked by others' agendas, but stay focused on the gospel of Christ being advanced. Wow, I think that's what it's all about. So, here's the big idea. Let me just kind of review it. God isn't finished with you yet. We're a work in progress. He will be faithful to do his part in your life, transforming who you are, using the ultimate quality of love, which really at the end of the day will bring and reveal the glory of God. And we are not victims of our circumstances. God would like to use them to advance the gospel. And don't be dissuaded by the ill intent of others. It's not the point. Don't get distracted. It is advancing the gospel that is the issue. So it's perspective. It's our perspective, how we see it. So let's go back. How can we integrate this dichotomy? By having perspective. How can we keep perspective? By seeing it from God's point of view. And how do we get God's point of view? We see it in his word and in his son. So let me just wrap up by saying this, asking you this. Go back to that one-point perspective. In spite of all the highs and lows, in spite of all the goods and bads, in spite of all the victories and defeats in our lives, Paul believes that God is trustworthy and that he is inclined towards us rather than against us, and that living with that in mind can set our direction and it can establish our stability even in a world that is beyond our ability to control. He can. So let me make it personal here for a second, okay? So we all have to ask ourselves the same question. Here it is. In spite of all the highs and lows, goods and bads, victories and defeats in life, do you believe that God is trustworthy? Do you believe that he is inclined toward you rather than against you? Do you believe that living with that in mind can set your direction and establish your stability, even when the world is beyond your ability to control? And the way we rewrote this deserves a question mark at the end. Do you believe that? Can you engage that? With whatever circumstance that came to mind as we read this, and whatever opposition there might be in the gospel, to think that God can use it to advance his kingdom. And God doesn't need us to be distracted by those in envy and rivalry, but to know that the gospel is moving forward. And then you are set free to live much more joyfully, right? Because Paul says, and in this I rejoice. I rejoice in being in prison right here in Rome. They're thinking about cutting my head off. I don't think he probably thought that was the coolest thing in the world, but he wasn't really deterred by it. Because he said, man, if it happens, I get to be with the Lord. Wow. That'd be great. But if I can stay and work, super. And there are people who are trying to undermine what I've done for 30 years. Big deal. It is the gospel that moves forward. I have a feeling he slept well at night because he knew that God was in charge. So for you, are there any things that you need to say, okay, God, move my circumstances not away, but use them. Move it so that I can use it for the gospel. And God, in the ministry, may I focus on the fact that your gospel is going forward, the truth of who you are and what you want to do. Wow. What's going on in your life? Where does that need to apply? Where does it touch you? Right? So here's what I'd like you to do. Just take a minute and where you quietly can push the world away and say, hey, Lord, speak to me. Speak to me about my circumstances. Speak to me about where I'm at and what you want to do, how I can trust you, and let him speak to you. All right? Take a minute just to pray. Wrestle with the Lord. So let's pray. Father, I pray that you would listen to the hearts and to the words of your people. If there's anybody here that has yet to come to know you, I pray that you would draw them to yourself, that you would reveal yourself to them, that this perspective is what you would like to give them. Father, speak to us about our lives.